Okay, this week is Parshas Mishpatim, which begins on page 416 in the Arutz Kol Chumash. And today, what I'm hoping to do in the plan that I have is to go through a few select portions of the Parsha and compare them to the way the same topic is addressed elsewhere in the Torah. We know that the number of mitzvos appear, well, firstly in Parshas Mishpatim. Parshas Mishpatim is really the first Parsha that makes it its business to share with us mitzvos. The mitzvos which are in Parshas Mishpatim are primarily, between man and one's fellow man, in the sense that it refers very much so to circumstances under which somebody damages somebody else's property or somebody else's person, and therefore what the requirements would be insofar as how a case would be adjudicated in a Beit Din, in a court of law. So, Parshas Mishpatim, I didn't count, I don't remember, but I think it has somewhere in the realm of 50 mitzvos or so in the count of mitzvos of the Torah. It's a pretty sizable percentage. There are parshas which have more. Kiseitse has more. Maybe a couple others have more. Shoftim has a lot also. Anyway, it's an overall theme of the parsha. But insofar as trying to point to general themes, you don't have it. You can't say, this discusses all things related to, because it jumps around from different topic to different topic, and so a lot of things are covered, but they don't carry a specific theme. So what I want to look at today is the first mitzvah which we have in Parshas Mishpatim, which is Eved Ivri. Excuse me, yeah. That is the laws surrounding what Art Scroll translates. If you look in the comment on the left side, page 417, you see it says Jewish bondsman. Okay, and that's an interesting choice of terminology, as we'll soon see. Then I want to look at the rules surrounding how one treats the animal of one's fellow who is weighted down by a load, excuse me, and then we will look at the narrative, which is at the end of the parsha, and that surrounds the events of Har Sinai, of the giving of the Torah. Okay, so those are the three topics that I want to look at today. Okay, so we start in the beginning of the parsha, and it says, "Ela mishpatim asher tishim lefneihem." These are the laws which you're going to place before them. Kisipnei v'divri, when you purchase a Jewish bondsman. Okay, that's an interesting translation that the Art Scroll uses, and we'll hopefully soon see why it's not just interesting, it's probably a good translation. Even though we normally translate the word Eved as a slave, but is this a slave? Not so clear that this is a slave.
A worker.
Okay, that could be. Worker is a very nice word for Eved. I don't know that it's okay, anyway, in Begapoya vo Begapoya itse, if he's single when he comes in, then he should leave single. In Baal Ishahu, if he is married, then the Yatza'a Ishto Imo, then his wife would leave with him. In Adonavi Ten Lo Isha, if his master gives him a wife during the time in which he is serving as an Eved Ivri, and how long does he serve as an Eved Ivri? We saw in the first verse, 6 years, Shei Shanim Ya'avod, 6 years, and in the seventh year he's free, in other words, after the 6 year period. And the six-year period is dependent on when he starts. Okay, I remember.
I'm sorry. They make a differentiation here in terms of he's the husband of the woman, and then the difference is if the master just gives him a wife.
Yeah. We're about to see. In other words, if he's married when he becomes an Eved Ivri, then his wife could live with him, and then of course she. She's not subject to this idea of being an Eved. A slave or whatever, bondsman. So she would go. She doesn't become the property of the master. That's basically what's being said here.
Him.
What?
The master's buying him.
The master is
buying them.
I don't want to say buying. Buying's not the right word.
Well, it does say
I know buy. It does say sikne, but we're going to see what that means. Okay. However, if the master gave him a wife, And she gave birth to sons or daughters during the time when he was his bondsman. The woman and her children remain essentially the property of the master. And he goes out alone. Remember, he came in single, so he can leave single. However, if the guy says, he says, you know what, I like it here. I like my master, I like my wife, I like my kids. I don't want to leave. In other words, don't separate a family, you know, for example. Then the master brings him to Ha Elohim, is an interesting word. Of course, in this case, it refers to the court. And in a number of cases in Parshas Mishpatim, Ha Elohim refers to the court. So then he's put at a door, and a hole is put into his ear with some kind of awl, and he is avado le'olam, and he becomes a servant forever. Now, what does a servant forever mean? The Gemara tells us that it means until Yovel. I believe Rashi mentions that as well. Yeah, Rashi says ada Yovel, until the Jubilee year. And by the way, the Jubilee year could be any time within the next 50 years. It really depends on when he started to become a servant. Now, that the fact that he remains a servant until the Yovel does not mean that the 6 years that he works and the seventh year which he goes free has anything to do with Shemitah. Okay, so I want to make that clear. That Shemitah is a seven-year cycle of the land of Israel in which people work the land for 6 years, and on the seventh year the land lays fallow. So it's similar in that he has a six-year time of working for his master, and in the seventh year he goes free, but it has nothing to do with Shemitah. Okay, it's a different count. Yovel, on the other hand, is a fixed marker on the calendar. It's once every 50 years, and so depending on when he becomes this bondsman, in comparison to when Yovel is, he would remain until that Yovel year comes along. Now there are other things about Yovel which we know. I don't know if we touched upon this in the. Oh yeah, I mean when we talked about Geula a few weeks ago in Parshas Va'era, so I noted at the time that the Geula refers to things going back to the way that they were before, and that term is really used a lot in reference to Yovel, when property that somebody had owned in the past, which had been sold or leased, more likely, goes back to the owner at the Yovel year. And so in the case of Yovel and property, people would look at the calendar and say, when is Yovel? Okay, so how long am I going to have access to the use of this field? So if Yovel is in 10 years from now, so I'm going to pay you a lease for 10 years, and therefore the price is going to be much, much less, knowing that in 10 years I have to give the property back, as opposed to if I get it when there's 40 years until Yovel, then a very different price. So I'm not going to start getting into the economics of it, but obviously things would be determined knowing how far away Yovel is. So when it comes to this, I don't know if there's a determining factor in terms of the economics, but insofar as this Eved Ivri and his being connected to the master, so that's what Le'olam means until Yovel. And now we have to understand so two things. Number one, the wife which the master would give to the Eved Ivri is a woman who we typically identify as a Shifcha Kenanis. In other words, she is not a Jewess. She is not a Jewess. What that means is that this is an allowance that the Torah gives for a Jewish male to have marital relations and really get into a full-fledged relationship with a non-Jewess, and the purpose of it, first and foremost, is to produce more slaves. If you think about it, right? In other words, the product. What's our view? What's our view of the? I mean, it's to give the man companionship on the one hand, right? But it's also to produce more bodies for the master. Now, what's our view of the product of a woman insofar as his, let's say, Jewishness or other ethnic identity? Okay. That he follows the mother. Okay, so if this lady is a Shifcha Kenanis, and she's a Canaanite slave, then her children Shifcha means a mate. Well, it's a female version. Okay, so you have either an Eved or with females, either Amma or Shifcha. Okay, Shifcha means maid, Amma means maid servant. I mean, but it's similar. I don't know the distinctions between Shifcha and Amma, to be honest. But yeah, those are different words which are used in the feminine. Okay, you don't call a woman an Eved. Okay, a woman is either a Shifcha or an Amma. Those are the Hebrew words for it. So anyway, so the child follows the mother. Right? We're familiar with such an idea. Okay, and certainly in Jewish, we say matrilineal descent. The child follows the mother. So similarly here, by the way, that becomes a big source of contention nowadays. You know, there are, you know, lo aleinu for us, but there are Jewish women in Israel who sometimes become enamored by an Arab man. And I'll assume that it's voluntary. Let's assume that it's voluntary for a moment. In the Muslim world, what does the child follow? The father. And the Jewish, it follows the mother. So you know, the children of this union, we're all making equal claims on the child. So it's a big problem in certain areas where Jewish women, unfortunately, they fall into the, again, assuming for a moment that it's voluntary, okay, but they're putting themselves in this situation until they realize, wait a second, I don't really want to be here, and then what? Okay, that's a different conversation. Anyway, but yeah.
I love my master and I love my wife. What happens if you don't love the master but you love the wife?
Right. So, I mean, it doesn't say ahavti es adoni vi es ishti vi es banai. It says es ishti vi es banai. So, in other words, what's keeping the person here? I mean, okay. So, I mean, that's going to get into the next point that I want to discuss about what this evet is versus what this evet is not. Okay. But I just want to get back to that point. So that the children here. So he may have feelings. I mean, it's natural to have feelings for one's children, even if one's children do not follow the same ethnic identity. Officially, but I mean, we know the reality is that it's 50%, right? I mean, the child is 50%. Certainly, DNA wise and genetically is 50% the parent, even if we don't say that the child is a Jew. But there is the other component to it, and that is that the master at any time is allowed to free the woman and the children. And what is the law, the halacha of a freed Shifcha Kenanis that are free? Eved Kenani, right, that's the male and female version of Canaanite, slave or whatever, is that they can become a Jew. They or I don't know if they automatically, but they definitely can become a Jew. So there is always that option, and there is always that reality that part of the process of freeing them turns them into a Jew. Do they have to go through a conversion process? I don't know the whole process of an Eved Kenani or Shifcha Kenanis becoming free, if it has to be a conversion process, but they can become a Jew. Okay, well, it's a very simple process, and part of the presumption of that is that simply because of living in the household of a Jew, they've become very accustomed. I mean, listen, we all know, whether we've had the experience personally or whether we just know of it, right? The people who once upon a time grew up, and certainly this is true of like a full-time janitor in a shul, for example, they know a lot about Judaism. You know, they can speak the lingo better than some of our own people, right? You know, they'll tell you about Shabbos. Oh yeah, I heated up the challah, you know, the kugel. I mean, they know a lot. They know a lot. Did you lose your tefillin? I mean, you know, the lingo, because you're around it. So somebody who's around this and is treated in the right way just becomes accustomed to it. We have a halachic category of nashim, avadim, and ketanim. Nashim, avadim, and ketanim. Nashim are women. Avadim are what? Not Eved Ivri, Eved Kenani, and children, minors under the age of bar mitzvah. That they're all like partially obligated in mitzvos. What does partially mean? That there's a limit. We're familiar that women are not obligated, for example, in mitzvos asei she'azman graman, time-bound mitzvos. Okay, so there's a limitation on certain obligations. Doesn't mean that you can't participate, but it means that you can't be motzi somebody else their obligation. Right. In other words, if the level of mitzvah, for example, in sitting in the sukkah, let's say, is so, can you make a bracha on sitting in the sukkah to be motzi somebody who has a higher level obligation? The answer is no. The person has to make their own bracha. Okay, can you be motzi other women? You have the same level of obligation. The answer is Yes, absolutely. This is the biggest place where this comes up as a question is in the reading of Megillah, which I don't want to get into now. But there's a difference between the nighttime reading of the Megillah and the daytime reading of the Megillah insofar as men and women obligation. So much so, and I always forget which one is which. I think it's the daytime one that women could be motzi men for. Okay, because same level obligation as opposed to the nighttime, which where the men have a higher level obligation. It's an interesting discussion. But anyway, so getting back to this, so you have that component in terms of that women, avadim, and ketanim are all in the same category of obligation of mitzvos, which is, again, it's a topic of a different discussion, but the point is that avadim are there, which means that they're already kind of halfway, you know, in their own way. I'm not saying that they're all, obviously women and children are not the same, but insofar as they're being a halachic category, it is a halachic category. I'm not comparing the groups in terms of status, maturity, knowledge. That's not what I'm saying, but it's a halachic category. And, okay, so that's one thing to bear in mind. Another thing to bear in mind is this whole question about what does it mean to be an Eved Ivri? What are the rules surrounding an Eved Ivri? So we know from other places in the Torah that the reason why a person would become an Eved Ivri is not because, you know, the person was thrown into a cage and then shipped overseas and then they end up in somebody's house and now you're a slave. The reason an Eved Ivri becomes an Eved Ivri is because the person is either in dire straits in need of funds, or the person has stolen, has done a crime, and is required to pay back, and they just don't have the means to do so. And insofar as the way that the person, therefore, is treated during this time period, the person, I mean, first of all, is given, you know, technically could be given a wife, or his wife could be brought into the household, and the master takes responsibility for these people as well. And the treatment of this Eved is described in the Gemara Kedushin in very high terms of how, you know, who gets priority with I mean, just some of the examples that are given is, if there's one pillow available in the house, who gets it? The master or the Eved?
The Eved.
If there's a nicer piece of meat, who gets it? The master or the Eved? Okay, the Eved. So what you see here is that there's already a thought process that we're treating this person on a higher level. Okay, that's number one. Number two, it's more of an apprenticeship. It's like the old, you know, the Chinese proverb, teach a man to fish, right? So the idea is that that this person who clearly was not able to make it on his own for whatever reason, that's why he's either in dire straits or he stole, this person is being given it's a training program for 6 years to say, hey, how are you going to make it on your own? And during that time, what is the master supposed to do? Treat him very nicely, take care of him, provide food, clothing, shelter, etc. And whether the person is on salary, I don't know if he's on salary, but he doesn't have monetary needs during this time period. And the point is that when the 6 years are up, you're supposed to be able to make it on your own. The idea of knocking the ear is because, you know, as Rashi says, you're choosing to be an Eved to a person when the whole reason why you became my people was because I freed you from being Avadim to a person. You were Avadim to Paro. And so the ear is what gets the whole board into it, because the ear isn't listening to the Torah. Okay, so that's the background. So where else are we told about Eved Ivri? So there are at least two other places in the Torah when we are told about Eved Ivri, and a good way to remember it is whenever you have the discussion about Shemitah. Eved Ivri is right next to it, which begs a very interesting question about what does Eved Ivri have to do with Shemitah. But anyway, that's also for a different discussion. Turn the page to page 700. Sorry, not 700. Seven oh two. Okay? If we have time, yeah. Okay, I want to do what I prepared first, but yeah. I mean, I could just say parenthetically that with the question of the sale of the daughter, it's a, it's It depends on how you know what your perspective is. In Israel, they call you know, whenever the army or the prime minister or whatever is subjected to questions about the treatment of you know, Arabs or whatever, they call that hasbara. You know what hasbara is? Explaining things, right? You know, and what do they call twisting? You have to put things from a perspective that is palatable. So that circumstance that you're asking about, the Amma Ivriya, that's the Jewish maidservant, is a very difficult circumstance where, similar to the poverty of the man who is able to sell himself into this bondsmanship, here's a man who can't take care of his daughter for whatever reason. And so he puts her into a household where she'll work, you know, but at the same time, she'll be taken care of in a way that he simply can't. Now, as far as the whole question of her being married to the master or the master's son, so there isn't enough time to explain that now. But the point, more than anything, is to show that she's being taken care of, more than I think she's being sold into like being a sex slave, which I think is not what the goal of the Torah is here. Okay, let's take a look on page 702 at the bottom of the page. Okay, now in Parshas Bahar there are a number of different circumstances. If you actually go back, just go back to page 700. So you'll see, starting with the English doesn't do it as well, but in the Hebrew you could see where the break is at 25. Okay, so you could look in just 25. If your brother becomes impoverished and sells part of his ancestral heritage, so that has to do with Yovel, the selling of things. Okay, and that's the next little paragraph as well at Chamishi, verse 29. If a man has to sell his residence, and the reason why a person would do this is because they need money. Turn the page to 702 again. Look at that little paragraph break, Pasuk Lamed Hey 35. You'll see V'chi Yamuch Achicha. If your brother becomes impoverished and his means falter, you should strengthen him so he can live with you. In other words, that's a mitzvah of giving tzedakah and not taking interest. Now you move on to 39, and this is our topic. V'chi Yamuch Achicha V'nim Karlach Lo Savod Bo Avodas Avid. If your brother becomes impoverished with you and is sold to you, you shall not work him with slave labor. Whoa, okay, what does that mean? So, yeah, what does the word eved here have to do with avdus, slavery? That's the only thing it has to do with it. It's the same word. That's it. It's the same word, eved. But in terms of the treatment of this eved ivri, you do not do slave labor. Like a laborer or a resident shall he be with you, until the Jubilee year he shall work with you, and then he shall leave you, he and his children with him, he shall return to his family, to his ancestral heritage shall he return, for they are my servants, God says, whom I have taken out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold in a manner of a slave. You shall not subjugate him through hard labor. You shall fear your God. Okay, so this is the instruction that we're given with respect to the Eved Ivri here in Parshas Bahar. And what are we essentially told? Right, you have to fear your God and therefore treat this person with heightened sense of dignity. Again, it's a training program more than anything else to help the person become independent and not needing to go through the means that the person went through to get to this stage. Okay, it's page 1016 in Parshas Re'eh, chapter 15. Verse 6. But actually, if you look at the next page, you'll see at the top of the page it says a Jewish bondsman on 10:19. But let's read through this quickly. I'm going to read it in the English just to save time. If there's going to be a destitute person among you, back on 10:17, at verse 7. If there's going to be a destitute person among you, any of your brethren, any of your cities in your land that Hashem your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or close your heart against your hand against the destitute brother. You shall open your hand to him, you shall lend him his requirement, whatever is lacking. Beware lest there be a lawless thought in your heart, saying the seventh year approaches, the remission year, and you'll look malevolently upon your destitute brother and refuse to give him, then he may appeal against you to Hashem and will be a sin upon you. That is a concern of what's called the canceling of loans. that comes with the Shemitah year. So in other words, what that pasuk is telling us is that a person should not say, oh, Shemitah's coming, if I give a loan to somebody who is in need, well, they may not pay it back in time for Shemitah, and the loan is going to be canceled based on Torah law. So I'm not going to do it. There are ways around that, and that's, I'm sure some of you have heard of the concept of the Prizbol, giving the loan officially over to the Beis Din, because it's only private loans which are canceled, but not loans which are done by a public, or in the hands of a public entity. So since the Beis Din is considered to be a public entity, any loans which they are supervising are loans which are considered to be of the public. And so it's a document which people will often sign in advance of a Shemitah year to make sure that loans which they have will be handled by the Beis Din. And of course the Beis Din has interest in returning money to the places where it belongs. And so therefore that's a I don't want to call it a loophole, but it is a It's a later kind of innovation which was made to simply put Jewish law into effect in a way which was equitable for everybody. Okay, in other words, why should a person take a loan knowing that it's going to be canceled? That's not exactly honest. And why should a person give a loan knowing that it's going to be canceled? What a loss! So doing it through certain processes. And is something which in the end I think helps everybody. So
if the loan is canceled, but if somebody wants to voluntarily pay you back, that's what you can take the money from?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay.
When you say Beis Din has an interest in getting the money back to the rightful owner, does that mean that Beis Din makes money on it?
So I couldn't tell you about how each Beis Din operates, technically, they should not on this in the transference of this money, but at the same time, listen. Every court has to operate in a certain kind of way. You know, it's like today. Now, one of the things that I was thinking about talking about today, but I'm not going to, is the question of going to Beis Din versus going to secular court. Okay, and it's interesting. You know, halachically speaking, anything that can be resolved in Beis Din should be resolved in Beis Din first and foremost. If it can't be resolved in a Beis Din should be able to say, listen, this is out of our domain. You know, you guys are talking about a suit of millions and millions of dollars. We're not presiding over that. So if that's the case, then that's a different discussion. But you know, a court, for example, I mean, they may have court fees and whatever, and there's taxes and who's getting paid by what, as opposed to a Beis Din, which doesn't, you know, has to have their own court fees. So when people come in front of the Beis Din is going to say, okay, we will, you know, adjudicate your case, but it's going to cost each side, you know, a couple hundred dollars. And it's not unreasonable, but just some people, they're like, I don't want to pay the Beis Din. Like, the Beis Din should be free. Okay. You know, so it depends on how much money is at stake here. If you're in court over a case of $500 and paying $500 to the Beis Din seems to be rather silly, right? But if it's a case of, you know, many tens of thousands of dollars, then $500 might be worth the court fee. Okay. Anyway, page 1019. So if your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, so you'll see that it's not calling them an evid. Just to go back to your point, it's ivriya. Ivriya is the feminine of ivri, which means a Hebrew. So they work for 6 years, and in the seventh year, you shall send him away for you for free, which is the same, you know, male or female, even though it's speaking in the masculine. But when you send him away from you free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. Whoa, look at that. It's not just like, oh, civil war over, all slaves are free, good luck. It is, adorn him generously from your flocks, from your threshing floor, from your wine cellar. As Hashem your God has blessed you, so shall you give him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Hashem your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you regarding this matter today. In the event he will say to you, I will not leave you, for he loves you and your household, for it is good for him with you. Now, what kind of slavery is that? What slavery, what slave, when being given the opportunity to go free, you're not a slave anymore, says, hey, I like it here. I mean, that's not, when we think of slavery, we think of evil, we think of not nice, we think of mistreatment, we think of certainly taking advantage of, even if not beating and whipping, okay? But he says, I will not leave you, for he loves you in your household, for it's good for him with you. What is that? You can't call that slavery anymore. You can call that maybe being a servant at worst. What's a butler? Right? We've heard about butlers that were butlers for a family for generations. What does that mean? They like being butlers. Okay? So what are you going to say? Treat it nicely, right? Honor. Jeeves will take care of that. So then you shall take the awl and put it through his ear in the door, and it shall be for you an eternal slave. Again, eternal means until Yovel. Even to your maidservant shall you do the same. It shall not be difficult in your eyes when you send him away free from you. For twice the wage of a hired hand, 6 years has he served you, and Hashem your God will bless you in all that you do. Now, you see that line? Twice the wage of a hired hand has he served. That means that the wage of a hired hand is 3 years. Okay? And a hired hand is not considered an Eved. And what's the Hebrew word here? Is it a Sakhir? Yeah. Mishnes Schar Sakhir Avad Chasheshanim. Okay? So, in other words, this is an extended a kind of apprenticeship, if you think about it. That's what we're talking about. That's what this Eved Ivri is. So now, we can ask a simple question, and that is, well, if all of the things which we've just seen about Eved Ivri are true of an Eved Ivri, why aren't they all mentioned in Parshas Mishpatim? Why do we have to look and say, oh my goodness, Hebrew slave, what a terrible thing, what a horrible thing, and all of this. So, the ear, that's a harder question, and that goes back to the question of trying to explain things which are written in the Torah. It's more a message to the person. Now, how is it done? I mean, there are plenty, because I walk around, we all walk around, you look around, you see a bunch of people today who have voluntarily put all kinds of strange holes in their ears. So, I'm not, the idea that this looks like it's a kind of a punishment, okay, so it's a reminder, but what's he going to do with that hole? It's a sort of a branding, okay, but like I said, there are people who do that to themselves today, and to each their own. So, but the person understands what the cost of doing this is. The person is a Jew who's presumably understood that I'm an Eved Ivri, and this is the life, and this is what's going to happen. So fine. I don't think that that's as big of a deal in the larger scheme of things. I still don't know where in the ear this piercing takes place, by the way. That's one thing which I'm never quite clear on. Yeah, I mean, listen, and what if it's the earlobe? Right? Is it up here? I've seen people with holes. Just everywhere. Anyway. So why is it in these other parts of the Torah? So I don't know the answer to that question. To be honest, I mean, the one thing I can tell you is that Devarim, the book of Devarim, is Moshe's swan song, and we're told at the very beginning of the book that Moshe is telling over a bunch of things, and it's in the last month of his life, and he's telling the people. Things. So there are a lot of mitzvos in the book of Devarim which are repeated from elsewhere. If you look in the Sefer HaChinuch, for example, he's not going to list Eved Ivri here because Eved Ivri was already mentioned in Parshas Mishpatim. He's not going to mention it in the book of Devarim, in Parshas Re'eh. So what's Moshe doing is he's expanding upon things which he, I'm sure, had taught the people over time, but hadn't written them down. And then realized, I don't want to say that Moshe wrote the Torah not by God's instruction, but in giving over the speech, Moshe is telling people things which were not yet written down or included in the Torah. And in some cases, it's an expansion of something which we've seen before, which the people must have been told. There are many hints. Evidence in the Torah of the concept of Torah Shebal Peh, of the oral Torah that Moshe says, like I've explained to you. Okay, and what's he explained to us? Well, we don't have it in the written Torah, but we do have it in the Talmud. It's discussed. So was this oral law until it was written down? I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there as a way to try to at least understand why some of the information, which is clearly relevant to a mitzvah in the book of Shemos, wasn't recorded until the book of Devarim. Okay, but I think that through the different passages that we find in the Torah, both here in Mishpatim and in Behar and in Re'eh, we get a more wide picture of what this mitzvah is. And of course, in general, looking at things that we have in the Torah, just as how they're presented in the Torah, is never a good idea. Because there is so much more to be said about it, so much more discussed about it in the Talmud, in the halachic code works, and so therefore to just look at things in the Torah alone and say, oh, I don't understand that, or I don't like that, or I think it doesn't make any sense, or the Torah is nasty to people, is a little myopic. And it's important to understand that you know, what you, the little snapshot that you see certainly might not even be the only picture that you have in the Torah. I just showed you three passages on the same subject, and each one adds something to what we have in Parshas Mishpatim, and beyond that as well, in the Oral Law, which is now the Talmud and the Midrash, we have further expansions of these things as well. Okay, I want to look at one more topic before we get to the narrative portion. Yeah, go ahead.
How does that apply to today?
Well, we don't have this kind of setup. We don't really do this.
But I know, like, there is organizations, like, for example, a shul maybe, who would loan somebody some money, and they'd have maybe 7 years to pay it and it back. And if they don't pay it back, then...
Then we take their wife and children.
No, but so I'm just wondering if that's why all these kinds of things today...
No, so that's a different question. That's not servitude. That's not a bondsman.
Okay.
I mean, let's say a person would say, hey, listen, you know, we need custodial services in the synagogue, for example. Okay? And we'll help you out by giving you something to do, so, or helping somebody find a job. I mean, that would be more along the lines of it. And somebody who feels a debt of gratitude would stick with it. But the idea of this abdus is that the person is voluntarily, I mean, if they stole something, it's not as voluntarily. But let's just say voluntarily, they're going into this 6-year commitment, and you know, and at the end, as you see, the person has the option, you know, certainly is set free, and then has the option, not the option to leave, it's the option to stay if they want to. So it's just very different than other kinds of things which you see. So yeah, I mean, am I going to say it's irrelevant today? I'm not going to say it's irrelevant, but what I take from the mitzvah of Eved Ivri and Amma Ivriya is the responsibility on the Jewish people to care for those who are needy. And we have other mitzvahs of tzedakah, but this one is more, you know, like I said, teach a man to fish. You know, that's what I think Eved Ivri is more than anything else. Okay, there is a passage here, yeah, page 430. No, that's the wrong one, hold on. Okay, 432, it's on Pasuk Gimel. Okay. Ki sifka shoro yuchel chamaroto e hashev tishivenelo. If you encounter an ox of your enemy or his donkey wandering, you shall return it to him repeatedly. Kisir ech amor sonacha roveitz tachas masao v'chaldata mi'azov lo azov ta'azov imo. If you see the donkey of someone you hate crouching under its burden, would you refrain from helping him? You shall help repeatedly with him. Okay? Now, this passage is paralleled. What do we have there? Two psukim. One about helping an animal that's lost, and the other one about helping an animal that's overburdened. And not only that, but in both cases, it's described as the animal of your enemy. Somebody else. I once read this cute story about this fella who was driving down the road, and he saw somebody we didn't like who had a you know, a flat tire or something like that, and he said, you know what, it's not the same thing, but you know, it's what's a chamor? What's a donkey for? It's for travel. So the car is the equivalent of a chamor. Right, so he says, you know what? The pasuk says, help him. So I get out of the car, and he's so grateful that I came to help him. And so, as a result of our talking together, as we're fixing the tire, you know what? I discovered he's not such a bad guy, and therefore, you know, this is the lesson. He said, what genius, what wisdom in the Torah that it says, when you help out somebody who is your enemy, guess what could happen? You can actually become a friend. So that's a nice modern and contemporary lesson. Turn to page 1048. Now, and again, the fact that this is in Kisei Tse, in the Book of Devarim, just goes you know, to the same theme that I mentioned before, that Moshe in his swan song is expanding on things which were told before, and maybe it's a reflection of things which he explained to people up until now. Okay, I can't prove that, but certainly there's what to be said about mentioning the same mitzvah again with an expansion of the topic. Okay? So, we're going to read four psukim, okay? Starting at the beginning of chapter 22 on 1048. Lo sirah, okay? You shall not see the ox of your brother or sheep or goat cast off and hide yourself from them. You shall surely return them to your brother. This is achicha, right? Your brother. That's easy. That's not your enemy. That's somebody you like. If your brother is not near you and you do not know him, then gather it inside your house. It shall remain with you until your brother inquires after it, and you shall return it to him. Now, of course, if you hide it in your house and don't say, hey, I have a lost animal, then how is your brother going to know to knock? Again, this is a achicha b'mitzvah. In other words, it's your Jewish brother. It doesn't mean your physical brother or your familial brother. Okay, so shall you do for his donkey, so shall you do for his garment, so shall you do for any lost article of your brother that may become lost from him, and you find it, you shall not hide yourself. So that's the mitzvah of what's called Hashavas Aveda, for anything, it's not just animals, it's anything which is lost. Next verse, you shall not see the donkey of your brother or his ox falling on the road, and hide yourself from them, you shall surely stand them up with him. Okay, so what's the major difference between these verses and the ones which we saw before? I mean, the major difference. Whose lost item are we talking about?
Your brother.
Right, here it's your brother. In Parshas Mishpatim, it was your enemy. So what does that mean? It means that maybe if you're listening in Parshas Mishpatim, now you don't view people as your enemy. Maybe you view them as your brother. That's a possibility. But in any case, I think this is also an expansion of the mitzvah. In other words, maybe people looked in Parshas Mishpatim and said, oh, all right, I have to do that for my enemy. For my brother, I could just keep it because he won't care. He won't mind. He's my brother. Okay, so maybe the Torah is saying, I mean, I'm sure there are other explanations. I didn't look them up. But I just wanted to show you how a similar kind of mitzvah appears in two different places and how there is an expansion of it. And here, for example, the other expansion are the two verses in Pasuk Beis and Gimel, right, which talk about how you have to hold on to it in your home until the person looks for it, and how it also includes anything which the person loses, any lost article, including a garment that belongs to somebody else, that you have to do this mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. Okay, so there are a few different things included in this. Of course, returning an item, Hashavas Aveda, is one, and the other one is a sensitivity to animals, which is, I think, embedded in the Jewish people in a significant way. Right? I mean, cruelty to animals is something which we have other mitzvahs about as well. It's what we call tzar bali chaim, but tzar bali chaim doesn't mean about torture. Right? We have a mitzvah. There's a mitzvah. One of the seven Noahai laws is to not to eat animals. Not to eat from animals that are alive, or not to eat animals that are alive. This is one of the discussions regarding the coronavirus these days is about the live animal market that may have been the source of the coronavirus in China. They had to shut down these marketplaces because in certain areas of the world, they eat animals that are still alive. Okay, that's obviously anti-Noahide law, but we don't do that. And we also know that anything that's going to be any animal is going to be eaten. First and foremost, it has to be not just dead; it has to be killed in a manner which is considered to be the quickest way possible. And humane is to not kill at all. I think, right? So I don't want to say the word humane, but humanity was given animals to eat. We have that in the Torah. So following this, the prescript and how to go about doing that is a different conversation. But at the same time, we're talking about animals here which we are not eating. I shouldn't say that. I mean, you also have, what do you have? Shor and a seh, right? So, you have an ox and a goat. Those are kosher animals as opposed to a chamor, which is not. But it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really matter in the sense that there is a sensitivity to the plight of the animal, whether it is lost or whether it is being burdened, and therefore to ease its difficulty.
So, Rabbi, where it says you can shoo the mother bird away to eat the egg, basically, is that because
okay, so I'm going to tell you. So that's only if you need the eggs or if you need the babies. From I once wrote an article about this and was led in the direction of there's a book called Shiluach HaKein, which was published. I don't even remember who published it. Maybe it was R. Scroll Fellow. I don't remember. It's 440 pages long about that mitzvah that you're mentioning, and the main thrust or the main understanding that I have from that mitzvah is that It's not that if you come across a nest, you have a mitzvah to send away the mother bird. It's if you need the eggs, because you're starving.
To sustain yourself.
Or, right, if you need them. What are you going to do with baby birds, by the way, if they're alive? Nothing. In your care, they will likely die. In which case, you can't shech them. There's nothing there to eat. So what are you going to do with them? So the answer is, you know, eggs maybe you have a need for, but there isn't a mitzvah to actively seek out mother birds to shoo them away just to, you know, pick up their eggs. And there are people who believe that it helps with fertility. There are other things, I think, which help with fertility more than that. Tefillah, you know, for example, more than sending away a mother bird. All right, last thing for today. Go to the end of Parshas Mishpatim, chapter 24. I know we're basically out of time, so I don't want to overdo this, but I do want to draw to your attention what we have at the end of our parsha, and I'll give you for homework to make the comparison. Okay, page 442. No, it's 440. I meant the last paragraph. Okay, it's the last chapter, rather. I meant the last chapter. Okay, so it's chapter 24. So I'm really going to give you this more for homework, okay, than anything else. But what I wanted to draw your attention is chapter... You don't have to do it. I'm not checking. You don't need a letter signed, you know, that I did this at home. Your mother said you're absent. Okay. And if you come in to say that your dog ate your homework, I won't even ask if you have a dog. Okay? That's fine. You don't have to bring this in next week, but this is just if your curiosity is piqued enough, then you know I would encourage you to look this up on your own, and to make the comparison and to see, because we have at least three passages in the Torah, maybe a fourth as well, that discuss the events at Sinai. Okay, so we saw some in last week's parsha in Parshas Yisro, chapter 19. In the prelude to what takes place at Sinai, and of course the Ten Commandments, is in Parshas Yisro. In this Parsha Mishpatim, we have chapter 24, which has this instruction at the beginning. Moshe Amar, Eile El Hashem Atav Aaron Adavavu Shevim Zignei Israel. You, Aaron, Aaron's oldest two sons, the 70 elders, go up. Moshe goes up, a little further. And then it also describes how Yahushua goes up a little while later, and Moshe is told to do a number of different things. Moshe writes down the words of God, and Mizbeach is built. They build 12 monuments because there are 12 tribes. Moshe takes from the offerings that he brings, and he sprinkles some of the blood on the Mizbeach, on the altar, and he sprinkles some of it on the Jewish people. And in reading to the people what's called the Sefer HaBris, the Book of the Covenant, look in Pasuk Zion, verse 7, the second half of the Pasuk, Vayomaru, Kol Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh V'Nishma. Here's where the people say Na'aseh V'Nishma. Na'aseh V'Nishma, we will do and we will hear. That was not in last week's Parsha. Last week, all we saw was Kol Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh. Here, they also say in Pasuk Gimel, Kol Dvarim Asher Diber Hashem Na'aseh. And it's the addition of the word devarim, which is a question mark. Why is that there? But anyway, you see Na'aseh V'Nishma. Moshe sprinkles blood on the people, and he says, this is the blood of the covenant. Moshe goes up again. Aaron, Nadav, Aviu, the 70 elders, they see a vision of God in some way. Turn the page, 442. Then Moshe is told again, come up the mountain, and you're going to be there, and I'm going to give you the luchos, the tablets. And the Torah and the mitzvah that I have written, lower some to teach you. So what does that mean? God wrote out a Torah? Is that what that means? And Moshe and Yoshua go up. Hold on, wasn't only Moshe told to go up? Yoshua goes up. Vayal Moshe El Haro Elohim. Moshe goes up to Har Elohim. We talked a little bit about that last week. What's Har Elohim? Where he met Yisro, Har Elohim. And Moshe says to the elders, you stay here, and Aaron and Hur are in charge. Anybody has a problem, talk to them. And that's one of the reasons why when the people come to Aaron with the golden calf, the question is asked, where is Hur? And the assumption is that Hur has been killed by a mob because he was stopping them from doing their deed because Aaron and Hur were in charge. And then it describes how the glory of God is on the mountain for 6 days, and then he calls Moshe. Moshe goes into the cloud on the seventh day, and he's on top of the mountain. That is, and here it tells us that Moshe is in the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. Now, this begs a very interesting question. When are the Mishpatim, the laws of this Parsha, when were they taught to Moshe? So Moshe is going up in the mountain now for 40 days. Hold on, the Parsha of Eila Mishpatim was already told to us. So, right, is it out of order? That's why Rashi says things are out of order. So the other passages that we have, the other passage is most clearly in the book of Dvarim, chapter 5, when we have the second set of Aseres Dibros. So I'm not going to read it now because I want to respect your time. But you should go through it and compare what's there in terms of the lightning and the thunder and the people complaining to Moshe, we don't want God to speak, we only want you to speak, we're afraid, and whatever else is going on. How does it compare to what's going on over here? What gaps are being filled in the comparison of these narratives, and how does it all fit in the scheme of things in terms of when Moshe goes up the mountain? I mean, is there a passage of time? Do we have the dates right? Is really another question to be asked, because we assume Moshe goes up the mountain on the 6th of Sivan and comes down on the 17th of Tammuz with the Luchos, which he throws down and breaks. It's one of the observances of the fast of the 17th of Tammuz is because of the breaking of the Luchos. So do we even have the dates right? Which is another question. But to, just the point is that there are different narratives. And of course, where's that other narrative? In the book of Devarim. Were the people not there at the time? Well, maybe they didn't see everything that Moshe saw, because Moshe had a different perspective. And so Moshe, in sharing it, on the one hand, he's sharing things which none of us saw at this time, but he's also talking to a different generation. And that's important to remember as well, that he's talking to the second generation at the end of his life, and he's filling in things which maybe they didn't get from their parents back in the day, from the events that as they transpired in the book of Shemos.